Chapter 11. Just Friends. In my 30s, I was on three magazine covers, Avenue, Hamptons, and Hamptons Style. Now I was the cover girl for the overspending and corruption of the Trump Presidential Inaugural Committee. It was not exactly the trajectory I had in mind when I signed up for this patriotic journey. This was the price I paid for my own ignorance and not doing my homework, and jumping into the ring with people I really didn't know and trust, in an arena way dirtier and nastier than any I'd encountered before. I had been warned repeatedly to stay away from the Trumps, but didn't listen. I'd naively believed that because of my proximity to them, I could help change them and make a positive difference in the world. The truth is, you can't change people. They are who they are. And when people show you, time and again, who they are, you need to listen, even though you might wish with all your heart that they were different. From day one, I'd been in way over my head with the Trumps and simply biding my time until they deemed I was no longer of value. At such time, I was supposed to disappear and join the long list of former friends who were now considered vanquished. If getting rid of you could help them in any way, they wouldn't blink an eye. Even though the facts were wrong, the pain of public humiliation was very real. Once the headlines hit everyone's phone, television, and doorstep, I was afraid to leave my apartment. I embarrassed my children and my husband with my uncontrollable outbursts and constantly looked over my shoulder in fear that I was being watched and followed. My solution was to stop going out completely. I'd broken down entirely, and my former self was a distant memory at best. My friends worried about me. Many worried so much that they'd often show up at my front door, uninvited but always welcome. I'm grateful for every supportive email, text, voice message. I'm sorry I couldn't bring myself to reply to most of them. Another drop by guest was Michael Cohen. I'd known him for years. He had given me legal advice in passing. At the time, Michael was in the middle of his epic showdown with the president. He sat down with me in my den and said, "How are you, Steph?" "I was a freaking basket case. I can't stop crying," I told him. "Those motherfuckers threw me under the bus. I got fucked, Michael." Only the few people who'd lived in the trenches with me could relate and empathize. David Mann wrote repeatedly. Pamela and I spoke and cried so often because no one truly saw her side of the story either. My husband was furious about what had happened because he knew the truth. He saw better than anyone how much I'd sacrificed to work on the inauguration and in the White House, chiefly my health and our family time together with our kids. He also knew exactly how much I'd been paid by the Presidential Inauguration Committee. If he had known how much I'd lost on attorney fees for my three contracts, expenses at the Trump International Hotel, travel, hundreds of domain names, and numerous other expenses, he would have been sick. I reviewed old texts and emails, trying to figure out where things went sideways. I came across this text from John Reinaga on February 15, 2017, exactly 1 year to the date before the Scarlet Letter Times article came out. At the time, I was in Washington working with Melania on the Israeli state visit while John and Tom were having lunch in L.A. John texted me after lunch. "I will be away for 2 weeks and then mad busy in a project in L.A. I want to catch up. Given how much scrutiny the media is giving the administration, we cannot afford one single tiny mistake. So I need you to engage on this ASAP. Otherwise, in a few weeks, months, time, you'll be all over the press, negatively." I responded, "I'm at the White House now and will call you at 11 a.m. tomorrow." "Seriously? Negatively for what?" I had no idea what he was referring to, nor did I have the time to find out. John replied, "Could do," hence wanting it never to be an issue. "The press will be able to see the books and could say, SWW got paid $27 million for her role in the inauguration, or something totally untrue." And there it was in black and white, a narrative that could easily be sold to the press and the public. John and Tom had apparently talked about it over lunch. I believe John floated it out there to me as a subtle warning about what might happen if anyone poked around the PIC financing too closely. It hadn't even dawned on me at the time. Why would it? It must have occurred to them that if it became necessary to blame someone for the fuzzy finances, they could lay it at the feet of Melania's pal. It was a brilliantly conceived and even better executed plan. John had warned me, but it went in one ear and out the other, because I knew I was doing everything by the book. That didn't matter. Ivanka was right. Perception is more important than reality. Right then and there, poring over year-old texts, I solved the riddle of, who is she? She, me, is a sucker. It wasn't until 3 years after the inauguration that I discovered the $1.62 million consulting and supervisory fee paid to Wiz was earmarked as SWW executive consultation / management fee. If anyone saw that without knowing the facts, it would be construed that I, Stephanie Winston Wolkoff, SWW, personally received and retained the full amount. Could it be explained as an oversight? Or was it in fact well thought out with the goal of making me the scapegoat of overspending if ever the time arrived? And it certainly did. It was sleight of hand, creative accounting, bullshit at its finest, and the press ate it up, hook, line, and sinker. Catch and kill. I was still in Melania land. We continued to text and talk as if nothing had happened. I went along with it because I clung to the belief that she'd eventually defend me with the truth. After one of her regular, how are you? Kids? XO heart emoji? Texts? I couldn't bring myself to gloss over my feelings. I replied on March 13th, I am horrible. My kids are sad. None of this is easy. She sent heart emoji and folded hands emoji. John Marinaga stayed around me a lot. He often slept over at our apartment and told me, I am here for you, and I loved him for that. Promise me you won't do anything stupid. He was referring to the op-ed I was writing and rewriting over and over again, which never saw the light of day. Every day was Groundhog Day. What crushed me the most was that not one person came forward to defend me. Press requests came in from some journalists hoping to find the truth. Melania told me, put out your papers. She told me over and over to share all my receipts. I explained to her that, because of the Presidential Inauguration Committee's non-disclosure agreement I signed, I couldn't. On March 22nd, CNN's Anderson Cooper interviewed Karen McDougal, the 1998 Playboy Playmate of the Year, about her alleged 10-month relationship with Donald and the catch-and-kill deal she made with Trump friend and owner of American Media Inc., David Pecker, to keep it quiet. Cooper asked McDougal what she'd say to Melania if the First Lady were watching. She said, what can you say except I'm sorry? I wouldn't want it done to me. A few days after that, Cooper interviewed Stormy Daniels on 60 Minutes and pieced together a timeline of that one weekend in 2006 when Donald slept with the women on consecutive nights at Harrah's Lake Tahoe while Melania was recovering from giving birth to Barron. During the height of the Stormy Sturmandrang, a reporter from the Washington Post sent me a list of questions about Melania's aims as First Lady. Believe it or not, I was still fielding her press requests because Grisham was not responding. Melania most definitely did not have support, nor was her perspective covered by the press. The world only heard from Grisham, and not on behalf of the First Lady, in her inimitable combative tone. What this WAPO journalist didn't understand? Melania had no interest in revealing her thoughts, feelings, and perspectives about anything, let alone her friendships, including ours, which the reporter had asked about specifically, or Donald's affairs. After I forwarded the request to Melania, she wrote, Hi, how are you? I will pass on this. XO, heart emoji. Right now, her non-response cast her as either a long-suffering victim of her unfaithful husband or a cold-hearted gold digger. She refused to take action. I now realize Melania is not a normal woman. Two women had described having sex with her husband on national TV in graphic detail in the same week. Her private response, it's politics. Her public response, dead silence. It just wasn't a human reaction. Through the White House channels that remained open to me, I heard that Melania's staff was laughing at her behind her back. I texted Melania in April. You should know that Lindsay Reynolds tells everyone that she gives you a list of only 5 items to choose from with your red Sharpie, knowing you'll say no to 4 of them, so that you'll say yes to the one she wants you to choose. Melania said that is laughable. She wrote that there was no red pen and no one gave her 5 things to do. I am in charge of my own schedule. Then she said, I know you are still upset. Understatement of the century. A few days after our exchange, Betsy Klein of CNN wrote an article about the First Lady's team. Grisham described them as small but mighty. Klein had the audacity to claim that Melania's staff hadn't seen the rapid turnover and palace intrigue of her husband's West Wing, although they have lost at least 3 members since its inception. Considering the size of her office, that attrition rate might be on par with Donald's. Grisham said, we are a close-knit team. And I almost spit out my coffee. Poor Michael Cohen had admitted that he paid Stormy Daniels $130,000 in hush money, but was still publicly denying that Donald knew about it. On April 9th, Michael's home, office, and room at the Lowe's Regency Hotel were raided by the FBI. Agents claimed a reported 1.3 million files, acting on orders from the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York, SDNY. They had been alerted to Michael's possible criminal activity by the special investigation led by Robert Mueller. On April 10th, Trump tweeted, attorney-client privilege is dead. And on April 21st, I don't see Michael doing that, flipping, despite the horrible witch hunt and the dishonest media. The same day Donald was vouching for Michael Cohen's loyalty, Melania was at Barbara Bush's funeral. She famously smiled at Barack Obama, showing beautiful teeth, instead of giving him the pursed-lip grin she used around her husband. Donald didn't go, since he knew his presence would not be welcomed by the never-Trumper Bush family. Instead, Melania was accompanied by former White House head maitre d' George Haney and Buddy Carter, the butler I'd met my first week in the White House, who gave me the biggest hug when he was retiring. He was one of the only gentlemen I'd met in Washington. Nothing but the Be Best. On May 7th, Melania presented her Be Best initiative in the Rose Garden at the White House. She said, as a mother and as First Lady, it concerns me that in today's fast-paced and ever-connected world, children can be less prepared to express or manage their emotions and oftentimes turn to forms of destructive or addictive behavior, such as bullying, drug addiction, or even suicide. I feel strongly that as adults we can and should be best at educating our children about the importance of a healthy and balanced life. Pamela, Mark, Robin, our experts and I were supposed to be standing with her. But we had been replaced by other people, other institutions. Donald sat in the front row and made a big deal about signing her initiative with his illegible signature. He said, everywhere she has gone, Americans have been touched by her sincerity, moved by her grace, and lifted by her love. Melania, your care and compassion for our nation's children, and I have to say this and say it to you all the time, inspires us all. Melania didn't take questions or give interviews. Pamela texted me, I'm numb. I was, too. It was no longer the initiative we'd given life to, barely even a shadow of what it had been. Our ideas had been tossed around and chopped up. It was overwhelmingly obvious that Melania had been set up to fail. When we spoke, I congratulated Melania on the launch. She sounded chipper. She was excited that Be Best was finally a reality. The next day, her staff directed visitors to a downloadable booklet by First Lady Melania Trump and the Federal Trade Commission, with tips on talking to kids about the internet. Except for tiny changes, the content was exactly the same as a booklet put out by the Federal Trade Commission in 2014. Melania's people had borrowed from the Obama administration again, presumably without Melania's knowledge. They changed the booklet's authorship to the Federal Trade Commission, promoted by First Lady Melania Trump. FLOTUS MIA. On May 14th, it was announced by the White House that Melania had checked into Walter Reed National Military Medical Center to be treated for a benign kidney condition. I knew all too well about her kidney stones. The procedure had been described on the news as minor, and yet she wasn't released from the hospital for a week, or not. No one knew where she was. The media was not informed. Weeks went by without her attending an event or being seen in the White House. Naturally, her being missing in action again caused rampant speculation about her health, her recovery, and the state of her marriage. Melania texted me back on May 17th, that she was okay and recovering and not to worry. Have a great specialist. Hope you and the kids are well. XO, heart emoji. Good night. Sleeping dreaming emoji. Crescent moon emoji. On May 22nd, 1 week into her 3 week withdrawal from public view, we caught up by phone. She was in the White House, resting comfortably in the residence, not giving a shit. We covered the usual subjects, the kids, their schools. She was enjoying her game of hide and seek with the American people. Melania was still laughing about the media reaction to her mysterious absence from public view. Facelift? I'm too scared, she said. Nervous breakdown? I'm like, seriously? They don't even know me. My friend said, you give people nervous breakdown. You don't have it your own. Tell me about it, sister. The funniest thing was when Donald told the press outside, she's right up there, looking at us. And they look up, she said, referring to an impromptu White House lawn interview with the press, during which Donald pointed up at her window. I start laughing and said, oh my God, do they really think I'd wait at the window and wave at them? As if she'd acknowledged their interest and concern for her well-being. Yep, they have no idea who you really are, I said. Seriously, for me, it's nothing. I start laughing. Come on, they don't have nothing better to do? She asked. The jacket. On June 21st, Melania wore a green Zara jacket with the words, I really don't care, do you, on the back, as she boarded her plane to visit immigrant children who'd been separated from their parents at the Texas border. The nation's eyes collectively bugged at the sentiment. What did it mean? Was the message for Ivanka? Donald? Democrats? The media? It couldn't possibly be about the caged children, could it? On the day of, she texted me, liberals are getting crazy again, face with tears of joy emoji. For the record, Hervé had nothing to do with this. He didn't buy that jacket for Melania or design it. I never saw that jacket, he wrote. It's a nightmare for me. But as her stylist, people thought he was responsible for her wearing it. Within minutes, nasty, horrible messages started streaming to him, along with media requests and, in the days to come, cold feedback from vendors he was working with. I was also getting dozens of emails from reporters. I asked Hervé to get Grisham to do some damage control, but he was hesitant to insert himself. He was afraid to jeopardize his relationship with Melania. I don't dare, he wrote, and added, I am devastated. The whole country could not stop talking about the jacket. I was appalled that no one in the East Wing even attempted to come up with a rationale for her insensitive fashion choice. In a New York Times photo, Melania strolled outside the White House in the jacket, Lindsay and Grisham walking directly behind her, the lettering plainly legible. No one in her close-knit group could or would dare tell her to take it off. Melania and I had a 70-minute phone call on June 26th, several days post-jacket. For the first 15 minutes, we did the usual catch-up, kids, health, summer travel plans. She was still recovering from her hospital visit. I was dying to bring up the jacket, and when she mentioned an upcoming diplomatic trip, I segued in. I asked if Hervé was helping her for the trip and added, you know, he almost had a heart attack with the jacket. People are writing terrible things to him about it on his Instagram and Facebook. Bad comments are expected, she said. And that's too bad for him. He had nothing to do with it. My office had nothing to do with it. They are not my gatekeepers. I decide what I wear for myself. What prompted you to wear that? She laughed. I'm driving liberals crazy. You know what? They deserve it. I would have jumped on you to stop you, I said, which prompted a laugh as she imagined our rolling on the floor, my trying to get that jacket off. You warned me about the white suit, she said, laughing. Some people get too much into it. They connect stuff to my clothes, but they don't really know me. They think so much, their heads will explode. So you make your decisions and you have your reasons. But if you don't tell people, they'll come up with reasons for you, I said. I don't care what they think. They're always negative, she said. Melania wore the jacket to get the media's attention, she said. Otherwise, no one would have covered the story. The media never covers the good things, she said. They'd say, who cares she went to the border? This was a defining moment for Melania, and she wanted attention, just like Donald. Sure, the media would have covered it, but not the way they did. Melania, I said. When Grisham finally did make a statement, she said, it's a jacket, there was no hidden message. That was to your disadvantage and negated all the good that could have come from your visit. Isn't your truth, to my critics, I don't care what you think of me, and to my supporters, do you care what my critics think of me? All you had to say was, I am doing what is the right thing to do and visiting the children at the border. When you don't make a statement, people will go after you. She said, they're going to do it anyway, and they're always wrong. I wear what I wear because I like it. She mentioned that the day before, she had worn a pink Proenza schooler dress to welcome Jordan's King Abdullah II and Queen Rania to the White House. It was the day after the gay pride parade, and Melania said she was shocked that the press surmised that she wore the brand as a secret nod to the LGBTQ+ community, because Jack McCullough and Lazaro Hernandez, the designers, are gay. I read it and it's like, really? Excuse me? Are you kidding me? It never even crossed my mind. These people are really crazy and obsessed and stuff, she said. She was in a groove now, hating on the media. I've been getting visa questions again, she said, exasperated. I did everything legal and perfect. They all went crazy about the zero tolerance policy at the border. But they don't know what's going on. The kids I met were brought in by coyotes, the bad people who are trafficking, and that's why the kids were put in shelters. They're not with their parents, and it's sad. But the patrols told me the kids say, wow, I get a bed? I will have a cabinet for my clothes? It's more than they have in their own country where they sleep on the floor. They are taking care nicely there. And the mothers, they teach their kids to say, I'm going to be killed by gangs, so they are allowed to stay. They are using that line, and it's not true. They don't want to stay in Mexico, because Mexico doesn't take care of them the same as America does. Her comments made me queasy, but now I wanted to see how far she'd go. I've been working with a few charities to get supplies like diapers and bottles to the shelters. I said, if you're interested in getting the information, I can send it to you, and we can try to do something. She said, I can give you the names of some shelters. In other words, she wasn't going to get personally involved to help these charitable efforts. It sounded like she was regurgitating rhetoric about asylum-seeking mothers, criminals and murderers that the government rightfully should separate from their children. What about taking care of our people? She said. Many children in the United States are hungry, and now we're taking care of someone else's children? It's crazy. And then the media is negative about me going to the border to see those kids? Did Michelle Obama go to the border? She never did. Show me the pictures. Shifting gears abruptly, as she often does, Melania asked, did you go to the premiere of Andre's film? Is she really asking me if I've been to the movies? I looked around at the mayhem on my table and floor. It looked like I'd pillaged a Staples warehouse with all my binders of Presidential Inauguration Committee records and printouts of emails and texts. Plus, I knew I looked haggard. I'd woken up with a migraine and black circles under my eyes. I've been wearing the same flowered cotton pajamas for the last 3 days. She was referring to The Gospel According to Andre, a documentary about Vogue editor-at-large Andre Leontali, which had come out in April. I'd been cut off from the industry I once called home and my old friends, in part because I'd chosen to work for her. I simply said, I haven't seen it. Me either, but I read it was sad. It probably was. Andre had told The Guardian, his time since he'd left Vogue in 2013, people have dropped me because I am no longer viable on the front row. I feel sort of lonely. I could relate. Did Melania have the first clue what sad and lonely felt like? I wasn't so sure. I said, I'm not going to watch it. It'll be too upsetting, and my emotions have been out of control enough already. Stephanie, what doesn't kill you only makes you stronger. She'd said the cliche to me before, but this time it didn't hold the same gravitas as it once had. I felt like replying, easy for you to say. Andre had emailed her, she revealed, to congratulate her on the white suit during the State of the Union. He was very nice, she said. As I listened to Melania ramble about her upcoming travel plans to Brussels and London, I realized she was oblivious to my reality. She was not weighed down by the burden of empathy, not one tiny bit, for me, Andre, or anyone. But I still cared about her. Part of my mind yelled, what is wrong with you? The heat is on, In July, news broke that Michael Cohen had secretly recorded Donald talking about making the McDougal catch-and-kill secret hush money payment via David Pecker's company. On the tape, Donald asked whether the payment should be made in cash, like a drug dealer or a John leaving money on the dresser on the way out. Donald tweeted his anger about being taped, but astonishingly continued to deny that it was his voice. What kind of lawyer would tape a client? So sad. Is this a first? Never heard of it before. Melania and I had a 2-hour conversation on July 31st, but Michael came up only briefly. I don't know what's going on, she said. I'm not involved with it. I expressed to her that I felt sorry for him because what happened to him happened to me, meaning we'd been loyal to the Trumps and then dropped when convenient. You need to go day to day, she said. Just know where the priorities are, and you cannot know what's happening tomorrow. You don't know what will happen in 2 days or 3 days. Stuff like that, you know? Platitudes. That was all she could give me. I played along just to see what she'd say. I love how you live your life, I replied. Nothing surprises me anymore, she said. Melania was in a very chatty mood. Anna Wintour gave the September issue of Vogue to Beyoncé, the cover, the articles, everything. They say it might be Anna's last cover. I don't know. And Annie Leibovitz shot the porn hooker. She pronounced it hooker. The what? I had no idea who or what she was referring to. Stormy, she said. She will be in Vogue. The buzzer in my apartment kept going off. I had to ask the first lady to wait a sec while I opened the door. Another delivery. Thanks to my terrible insomnia, I've been shopping online alone in bouts of midnight madness. The boxes would arrive, and then I'd return most of them. This was what my life had been reduced to. Melania said that her White House closet was bursting and that special stuff will go to a museum, adding, sometimes I wear stuff a second time. It's only clothes. As long as I have a space to put it, I'm fine. We talked about how she had worn a yellow dress that resembled Belle's gown from Beauty and the Beast. So they called Donald and me Beauty and the Beast, Melania said. They reported I wore a Raf Simons dress to Belgium because he's Belgian. I had no idea. Always the same, I thought. She does what she wants and doesn't think anything through. She said, I'm so glad I didn't do that profile in Vogue. You know, they came back 2 months ago and asked me to do it again. It might be a cover, they said. Are you kidding me? I don't give a fuck about Vogue or any other magazine. They would never put me on the cover. All these people are so mad. Some people say they're all jealous. They want to be you. They cannot believe that I still look good despite all these designers who refuse to dress me. Like I need their help? I don't need to prove anything to anyone. My life will not change if I'm on the cover or not. She really did live in a fairy tale where the queen rules from her throne and the little people were so far beneath her, she couldn't even see them. It was time for one of us to speak up. I'm so depressed from what's happened to me, I said. I want to be positive, but I can't. I'm stuck. Maybe you think too much. You're analyzing too much. Maybe you should move forward and have different goals. This, from the person who never analyzed anything. I replied, I'm still working with Mark Brackett and Robin Stern. I still care about what we tried to do. I hate that the people who did this to me also took that away from you. You could have done something bipartisan and actually made a difference. They hate Donald so much, they hate on me too. No matter what I say or do, Melania said. They say I'm complicit, so I work on Christmas stuff. Who gives a fuck about decorations? But I need to do it, right? So I tell them I'm doing Christmas stuff, and they say, what about children at the border? Give me a break. They will not do the story about the initiative. Yeah, if I went to Fox, they'd do it. But I don't want to go to Fox. She knew it would be a puff piece. I had to agree with her, but she'd allowed the press hate to happen. I told her, the journalists call me, say, the First Lady has no voice. Grisham took her voice away, and she's not nice. You can make friends with the press, Melania. They're not the enemy. But not with Grisham. She's way too combative. You have to do it with kindness. With a giant sigh, she said, I don't give a fuck. It's true. As soon as I didn't give them enough access, they got upset with me. But no matter what I give the press, it will never be enough. The First Lady can choose not to say anything, but her staff cannot, I told her. You're private, but you're not mean. The way Grisham treats the press is mean. You've got 3 more years to try to build better relationships and do some good. That was what I'd done for her. Since I'd left, no one had bothered. I know, she said. But I don't think anything is going to change. There's no point in trying. She'd finally acknowledged that her staff wasn't doing anything for her since my departure. Buzz, my door again, more packages. We both laughed. My laugh was from the relief that she'd admitted to me that her staff wasn't helping her. She did know the truth about Lindsay and Grisham, but she had resigned herself to throwing her hands up and saying, I give up. If I were still there, I would empower her to try harder. But I wasn't. A lucky break. In mid-July, Kenneth Vogel and Katie Rogers of the New York Times came to my apartment to try to make amends. Ken brought me a gift of a bottle of wine. They apologized and they acknowledged Haberman had the last word on that piece. So why would I speak to you at all? I asked. But I did. I needed to make sure they heard me out about the misinformation Haberman and Vogel had written about me already. In the middle of my tirade spewing out the facts about the inaccuracies of their reporting, my husband came through the door after a long day at work. I introduced Katie, and when I introduced Ken, I said, here's the ass that ruined my life. David took it from there. He didn't yell. I mean no disrespect, he said, but what the fuck? He just calmly questioned Vogel's ethics for writing untruths about me, defaming me, and disregarding the real story, for whatever his reasons might be, and for giving the Times readers a privileged woman to love to hate. You're the New York Times. You malign my wife for no reason. When you do that, you give Trump credibility when he calls you fake news. In this case, you did publish fake news, and people got hurt. He was my champion. Vogel and Rogers were kind of stunned and a bit shamed. I told them as much as I could, and we parted on good terms. Rick Gates testified in federal court in D.C. at the Paul Manafort trial on August 7th and admitted for the first time in court that it was possible he'd stolen money from the inauguration funds. Why hadn't Trump and Barrick made Rick Gates the fall guy instead of me? He would have been more convenient than me, since he'd been under indictment since October 2017. The problem was, Gates was a wild card. While I was being set up to take the fall, Gates was hiring and firing lawyers and having meetings that would lead to his making a plea deal with Mueller on February 15th, the same day the Times story dropped about me. The powers that be knew Gates had already agreed to talk to prosecutors, and they needed fresh meat. My friendship with Melania made a great headline, and I already had enough enemies who wanted to get rid of me. I was in the pole position and muzzled with an NDA. Could you ask for more? On August 17, 2018, the New York Times published a somewhat friendly article by Katie Rogers about Melania and included a decent description of the work I tried to do for her, setting up the East Wing, hiring staff, writing speeches, and developing the platform and its mission, in addition to overseeing the inauguration. She also wrote that I vehemently denied that my departure had anything to do with the Presidential Inauguration Committee. A quote from me appeared in the story. It unfortunately brought an abrupt end to the efforts and partnerships we developed to improve the well-being of children, which Mrs. Trump genuinely cares about, Ms. Wolkoff said in an interview. The end outcome was not what I expected, but this had more to do with other factions of the White House. Melania texted the basic pleasantries, hi, how are you? Then, your friend Katie Rogers did a nice story about you. Hope you are happy now. She sent a thumbs up and wished me a great weekend. I responded, Katie isn't my friend. She's a journalist doing her job, getting the facts right. I wish I could have told her more. Mr. Fix-It. On August 18, 2018, Michael Cohen called me. Hello, Steph, he said. The FBI and SDNY have the recording I made of our conversation. What are you talking about? I asked. A recording of what? Michael said, I recorded our conversation to use for contemporaneous notes. I was stunned. He continued, you need to have your lawyer get in touch with my lawyer to talk about whether the conversation is privileged or not. Privileged? I asked. What do you mean? Which conversation? When you were crying, he replied. Wait a second. I needed to digest what Michael had just told me. He had a recording of our conversation? The tape that was seized in the FBI raid? When did he tape me? He came to my house that one time and wore a trench coat. OMG, if that tape went public. Michael, why the fuck did you tape our conversation? I asked, beside myself. I had asked Michael for his legal opinion, not to record our conversation without telling me. He explained, I couldn't sit down with a notepad. I wanted to make a memo in order to strategize to exonerate you and clear your name. They destroyed you for no fucking reason at all, other than someone else took a lot of money and buried it in their pockets. And you had to be the fall guy, same way I'm the fall guy for Donald getting his putts licked by a porn star. I couldn't deny that. I asked how he was doing. He said, it's rough and going to get rougher. It's been 19 weeks since they've gone through every aspect of my life. It's destroying my wife and the kids. You know what's coming next? First they deny. They discredit. They demean, distract, and digress. That's not how the political world is supposed to work. He continued, I wanted to help Donald so Melania wouldn't kill him. For what? I'm being turned upside down. I didn't tape you for a gotcha. It was so we could sit down and create a memo to get your name cleared and let those who did wrong suffer. It shouldn't be you. The fact that you were crying really bothered me. The Trumps are not crying, and you are. That was the cue for me to start crying again. Look at what they did to me, I said, glancing at the state of my house, my face, my whole life. Look at what they're doing to me every day, said Michael. Every Wall Street Journal article. You think I don't know who's putting it out? Jared, Abby Lowell, Ivanka and Jared's lawyer, Don Jr. How do I know? People have told me. Who owns the Wall Street Journal? Rupert Murdoch. Fox News is state-run media. All I want is the same thing I was trying to do for you. Clear my name. Let them eat shit, which is what they should have been doing instead of throwing it on everyone else's back. They'll get away with it, I said. What they did on the inauguration was criminal. When I saw your binders, I said to myself, this is not someone who is doing something wrong. The level of precision, it's beyond anal. I'm super anal. You're beyond. I laughed. They wanted me to think I was crazy, I said. Melania and her downplaying her, don't be so dramatic, as if my reputation had just been dinged a bit, as if the stress of witnessing the inauguration self-dealing hadn't put me in the hospital. Shame on every single one of them, all the people who watched out for them, to throw us under the bus. That one article said you took money from the inauguration. Who do you think created that storyline? You know who did, I said. It was a PIC and White House-approved effort, all of which I have documented going from day one. Heather Martin and Tommy Davis gave the story to Maggie Haberman. Those motherfuckers threw it on me. I wasn't willing to keep my mouth shut, so they said, let's knock her off her high horse. He said, they threw you not just under the bus, but under a train. Michael warned me that, because of what I'd said on our recording, I might be called to testify in the investigation. Which investigation? I asked. Take your pick, he said. They might subpoena your binders. There has to be an end to all of the bullshit. Everyone can't be a fall guy for their malfeasance and corruption. Donald is the worst version of himself I've ever seen. Coming from Michael, who'd worked for Trump for over a decade, that was saying a lot. I broke into a cold sweat at the thought of being involved in an investigation. You should take solace in knowing that if the FBI or Southern District really thought you stole money from the inauguration, you would have gotten a phone call. How is Jared not behind bars? It makes no sense. Our intelligence community is the best in the world, and they don't know he's playing the Qataris against the Saudis for money? That triggered a memory. Once, when I was at a meeting at Colony Capital, I saw Jared come in, dressed in his white sneakers and blue blazer, for a meeting with a room full of Middle Eastern men in headscarves. I started to dial Melania's number before I even got out the front door. Guess who I just saw? I said to her at the time. Michael said, I ask people for money every day for the inauguration. Friends of mine. And for what? So they can walk away with $80 million? It's disgusting. It's so wrong. I want my life back. You and me both. Omarosa Manigault Newman had just released her book, Unhinged, about working in the White House, and she'd released a recording of her conversations with Laura Trump, Eric's wife, who'd offered her a high-paying job on the re-election campaign in exchange for her silence about the Trump family. Michael said, it didn't bother me one iota when Omarosa dropped the tape of Laura Trump. She married at third base and thinks she hit a triple. 3 days after this phone call, Michael pled guilty to 8 charges of tax fraud, tax evasion, and illegal campaign contributions. We spoke again on September 2, 2018. "What happens next?" I asked. "I can only surmise that it's not going to go well," he said. "They're going to come after me with everything they've got. Threats, intimidation, 50, 60, 80 counts of different violations for 300 years in prison. I'll be on the inside. But you, Steph, will be on the outside telling the truth. You will make this happen." I actually had to leave the house to go to my lawyer's office to listen to the Cohen recording. We sat in his office with a couple of other associates to listen to it. Every time I spouted, "fuck," "shit," "douchebag," and "motherfucker," I sank a bit deeper into my leather chair. The lawyers heard Melania's and my nicknames for some of the biggest players, like Dopey and Tuberculosis. I wanted nothing more in the whole wide world than the human right of being allowed to defend myself against the false accusations that had tarred my name and reputation. But I was muzzled by an ironclad non-disclosure agreement. The contents of the tape were not made public. I was not allowed to comment on it in the press or discuss it. As Michael had predicted, the recording did catch the attention of interested parties in the media and law enforcement, and an excerpt with me complaining about the Trumps charging way too much for a Trump hotel venue surfaced. Bless the rain. Melania and I were in loose touch in September. The summer went too fast. Melania texted on September 5th, wishing you all a successful year. On September 12th, she wrote, "Hope you're well. I guess you were at Fashion Week." Did she seriously think I was going to Fashion Week? I was barely functioning. No Fashion Week for me. I'm dealing with back to school, doctors, and paperwork. The paperwork in question? Collating and compiling a complete record of every email, text, and phone log from the day I joined the Presidential Inauguration Committee until now for the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York. "I'm always thinking of you, my dear sweet friend. I miss you," I said. On October 2, 2018, I received a grand jury subpoena from the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York. I also received a sealed order issued by the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York that prohibited me from disclosing, among other things, the fact of the subpoena for 180 days. The non-disclosure order from the Southern District of New York did not expire for 180 days unless otherwise extended by the court. The order will therefore remain in effect until early April 2019. I couldn't breathe a word to anyone but my husband and my children for months, because this had to be kept confidential from the Presidential Inauguration Committee and the White House. The investigations were underway, and they couldn't know. I wasn't allowed to tell anyone, and that included Melania. October took Melania to Kenya, where she wore a pith helmet reminiscent of colonialists from Europe. She said her sartorial choice offended the liberal media. I Googled what to wear on safari, saw the outfit, and liked it, so I bought it, she said. I wasn't making a comment on colonialism. Our last voice conversation was all about how little she cared about what people thought of her. On November 6, 2018, I received a surprise call. "Stephanie, Tommy Davis with Tom Barrack. I'm in New York as of Tuesday. Can you give me a ring when you get this call? I want to touch base with you on a couple of things, and yes, it's time sensitive." I didn't call back. My lawyer from Paul, Weiss, Rifkin, Wharton, and Garrison contacted Davis and informed him that he could address all of his communications to him and to refrain from contacting me directly. After I'd been subpoenaed, I didn't feel like chatting so much with Melania. It felt dirty. Texts and calls with her had slowed to a trickle after that. Right around the 2018 midterm elections, which brought a blue tsunami into the House of Representatives, she texted as if nothing major were going on. "Happy Thanksgiving. Hope you are well. I'm sure you're preparing for a feast there." I didn't reply. On December 13, 2018, the news came out that Manhattan federal prosecutors had opened a criminal probe into the inauguration spending and into whether some of the committee's top donors had traded cash for access to the Trump administration. The accounting didn't delineate where and how the donations had come in. Investigators were looking into whether extravagant donation packages offered FaceTime with officials, and if selling access explained the Trump inauguration's record-shattering $107 million cost, $50 million more than any other presidential inauguration committee. Melania sent holiday wishes in December, and on January 1st, she wrote, "Wishing you and your family a happy and healthy new year." I wrote back with my own message that I hoped she would have a happy and healthy 2019. Since then, we have not talked, texted, or emailed. On my birthday in 2019, flowers from Melania did not arrive at my door. For 14 years, she had sent something, no matter what was going on in her life. Her wedding, the swearing in, she always remembered. I had to assume she remembered my birthday that year, too, but she sent nothing. Despite everything, I was disappointed. Our friendship didn't end with a fight. It ended with an absence. I've thought a lot about my grandparents since my departure from the White House, the ruination of my reputation, and Melania's betrayal. I've been secluded and debilitated. While I could never compare what I've been through to what my grandparents went through, they witnessed the very worst of humankind. I do know what it's like to feel destroyed, rendered powerless. It's a feeling like no other because you are denied the human right to defend yourself. I have tried to match my grandparents' fortitude and resilience by putting challenges in front of myself, testing myself to see what I can endure. The force of Melania's personality blinded me to the truth about her and Donald's lack of character. But I wasn't the only one. They've pulled the same trick on about half the country. I didn't see it from the inside out, but once I was on the outside looking in, it became glaringly obvious. Now I can't believe how blind I was to the depth of their deception and lack of common decency. I put Melania's needs ahead of my own. I volunteered to break my back, literally, for her, for nothing in return other than a bunch of emojis. And she was happy to oblige. The biggest difference between Melania and me? I would never let a friend crash and burn for my sake. Never. I would never sit back and watch someone exhaust and sicken themselves for me. But she did. I doubt she lost a minute's sleep over it. Her selfishness is so deep and enables her to keep her distance from the rest of the world. It makes her untouchable. If she doesn't give a shit about things, they can't affect her. The wall around her is her defense mechanism. The secret to her happiness is to be authentically and unapologetically skin deep. She lives through her external attractiveness and how her appearance is perceived. Her behavior hasn't changed from her pre-First Lady days. She's just more visible now. After our breakup, I asked myself, did her character change, or was she always like this? Throughout the years of our friendship, our mutual affection, maybe all I really saw was her charming, warm, grounding personality. I gave her the benefit of the doubt about her moral character, the virtues of empathy and honesty I have taught my children. I have tried to live my life by the principle that what you do becomes who you are. I was Melania's enabler, and her using me became the basis of our friendship. I liked feeling needed. I believed she was a noble person and treated her that way, blinding myself to the truth about her to justify our long friendship. I used to think she was different from her husband. I saw streams of daylight between them and thought Melania was more principled, kind, and honorable than Donald and all of his offspring. I was wrong about that. A Trump is a Trump is a Trump. All along, I thought she was one of us, but at her core, she's one of them.